This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Warren Buffett's holding company, Berkshire Hathaway, owns more than 9% of Kraft Foods, almost 140 million shares. So what Buffett says usually goes, and today he said no deal on Kraft's offer to buy Cadbury. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Tuesday, everybody. It is the 5th of January today. Kraft's offer for Cadbury has never been quite sweet enough for the British candy maker. The chocolatier's been holding out for a better offer for a couple of months now. But today it became clear that the way Kraft wants to finance its proposed $16.5 billion purchase is a bit too salty for one of Kraft's best-known investors. Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway voted its 9.4% stake in Kraft against the deal today. It said the fact that Kraft was willing to use so much stock to finance things amounted to a blank check. Now, usually, it's good to hear about mergers. It's a sign the economy is humming right along. But Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson explains this particular deal may be more evidence that not every merger is a match made in heaven.
Kraft has been interested in gobbling up Cadbury for months. S&P analyst Tom Graves says it's especially tasty because of its international reach.
Cadbury has a major presence, you know, outside of North America. And in particular, I think Kraft is probably attracted to, you know, what Cadbury is doing and can do in the future in certain developing markets such as India.
But every reward has its price. And Berkshire Hathaway very publicly warned today that the proposed deal would dilute the value of stock for existing Kraft shareholders, like Berkshire Hathaway. Curtis Lyman, senior managing director with Hightower Advisors, says the warning was clear.
Look, fellas, this needs to be a logical, well-reasoned, thought-out business transaction that will ultimately deliver increasing value to the owners of this company.
Lyman says Warren Buffett, the Oracle of Omaha, may not have killed the deal altogether. S&P's Tom Graves says it could still happen if the price is right and if it can pass the wise acquisition test.
How well are the two companies going to blend together? How similar are the cultures of Kraft and Cadbury or any two companies that are looking to merge? What kind of cost savings are going to be able to be affected, you know, by bringing two companies together?
You know, the kinds of questions that the guys at Time Warner wish they had asked about AOL when they had the chance. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Oh yeah, that AOL deal. As if flat-screen televisions in high definition weren't enough, 3D TV is coming soon to a home entertainment center near you, with the mega entertainment industry gathering known as the Consumer Electronics Show set to get going in Vegas in a couple of days. ESPN announced today it's going to launch a 3D channel this coming June. The schedule will include World Cup soccer, the Summer Olympics, and college basketball, just for starters. Also today, the Discovery Channel said it's going to have 3D broadcasts going 24/7 by sometime next year, which distressingly raises the very real possibility that we're all going to need new TVs and set-top boxes sometime real soon. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
He gets the first carry. He'll walk to the end zone. Trojans regain the lead.
With USC's Trojans winning in the final minutes, September's football game at Ohio State was exciting enough, but it was even better for USC fans who got to watch it on a big screen in 3D. Media analyst Jack Myers has watched some of these test broadcasts of 3D TV.
It blows you away. You see the experience from the perspective of the rusher coming through the line and at you and being tackled.
Myers says 3D is ideal for watching live sports, but he thinks networks will eventually roll out everything from movies to musicals and nature shows in three dimensions.
That next wave of consumer excitement around new television purchases will be 3D.
Yep, he said television purchases. With a current high-def set, you'll be able to get about 2.5D, but to get the full 3D effect, you'll need a new TV. On sale soon at around $10,000 for those who can't wait for prices to come down. Carolyn McCarthy follows media at CNET. She thinks avid sports fans, at least, will take the plunge.
People do, despite the economy, want to one-up each other with, you know, who can have the best home entertainment and that sort of thing. And considering movie ticket prices just keep going up, some people may even find it a more economic investment.
The 3D glasses, they're a minor investment, and at least they're not as dorky looking as the ones they used to hand out in theaters back in the 70s. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
It's balmy today here in Los Angeles, but in a lot of the rest of the country, baby, it is cold outside. The winter weather that many places are feeling this week has helped drive crude prices on a 9-day rally. Oil hit almost $82 a barrel today. And Marketplace's Sam Eaton reports it is not just oil that the weather is affecting.
In a global economy, weather is still the wild card. And commodities analyst Peter Butel says it's now wreaking havoc on much of the Northern Hemisphere.
It's cold in Europe. It's cold across most of the continental U.S. It's cold in China. I don't know that we ever knew in the past when it was cold in all three places at the same time.
Which helps explain the recent rally in oil prices. But it also shows how much the weather plays a role in other global commodities. Forecasts for freezing temperatures in Florida have driven up orange juice prices. And snow in the Midwest gave corn prices a slight boost because of delays to the final harvest. Butel says combine that with other market factors and global commodities are looking like good investments in 2010.
With a weak dollar, with a strong stock market, with a resurgent economy, people are looking at commodities and saying that the demand is going to be higher. And they're also looking at this cold snap and saying it's going to be higher now.
But just how lasting the commodities rally will be depends on how long the cold sticks around. Daniel Bossi is an economist with Ag Resource.
On a longer-term perspective, we need that cold to be in place for not only a few weeks, but rather almost a month or two before it becomes a real significant market feature.
Which, Bossi says, hasn't happened so far. But that doesn't mean it won't. The forecasts for the eastern U.S. and Europe say the worst is still to come. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
Now, here's an interesting way to look at the auto sales figures that came out of Detroit today. When all is said and done, Americans scrapped more cars last year than we bought. 14 million sent to the junkyard, 10 million driven off new car lots. Ford finished strongest. Sales were down just 15% for the year. General Motors and Chrysler, well, yeah, they were worse. On Wall Street today, it was a split decision. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. With apologies to Dr. Freud, sometimes a cell phone is just a cell phone, and sometimes a cell phone is, oh, so much more. That was the case in Mountain View, California today, where Google made its long-awaited entry into the mobile hardware market. Miguel Helft covers technology for the New York Times. He also covered the Google announcement today. It's good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, we've caught you up at Google headquarters, I understand. What's going on up there today? Big phone announcement, right?
Yeah, Google just unveiled a new phone. This is a very slick device. It's a little bit thinner than the iPhone. It looks very fast and has some really cool capabilities. like the ability to input text by speaking into it. So if you're writing an email, you don't have to use the on-screen keyboard. You can just talk into it.
For all of that, though, the news out of Google today really isn't about this phone, right? It's about what it represents in mobile advertising and web going on people's phones everywhere, yes?
Right. We have to remember that Google makes its money by selling ads, not by selling phones, and that hasn't changed. But today, the company announced a new store, an online store, and this phone is only available on the online store. But I do not believe that's the goal of Google, to make money by selling hardware like, for instance, Apple. I think they really want to get as many Android phones into as many hands as possible, and they see this as a way to accelerate that process, because the more of these phones are out there, the more people click on ads and the more money Google makes.
Let me ask you this, though. If I have a smartphone and I have an app for, I don't know, Amazon, I'm just going to go straight to that app and then go to Amazon. I'm not going to go to Google and then type in Amazon.com and do a Google search, right? So there is a downside here, no?
There's certainly a downside, but the smartphones are coming and they're going to increasingly replace PCs as a primary way to access the web. And so whether you like it or not, people will have little applets that they can click on and go to Amazon or eBay and bypassing Google. I think the gamble that Google makes is that overall increased usage of the web, whether it's on a PC or on a mobile phone, will benefit it. And there'll be new ways to advertise on these devices, right? I mean, there'll be ways to offer you a coupon when you search for a camera and say, hey, there's a store two blocks away that sells it for $2.99.
How big is the ad market on mobile? I mean, how much upside potential here does Google have?
The projections for growth of the mobile ad market are all over the place, and like a lot of these things, they tend to be hyperbolic at the beginning. Today, mobile phone advertising, it's about 5% of all the money that is being made in the mobile internet economy. It is 40% on the PC. It's not clear how much upside there is on the mobile phone side, but it's probably significant.
Nobody at Google will probably answer this question should you pose it to them, but how much danger are they in, really, of sort of losing their position as the web moves from PC-based on your desktop to these things you carry around in your hands?
Whenever there's a shift in computing, whoever is the leader should be worried about maintaining their position. And Google has moved very aggressively to do that. It's acquired a whole bunch of mobile phone technology startups. It's really pushed the carriers and the handset makers to make the mobile web, which used to be controlled very much by the carriers, to look more like the PC web, where, you know, any application, you've got a device, you can install any application you want, and that's good for Google. So should they be worried about this transition? Sure, but if they play it well, it could be a great opportunity for them.
Miguel Helft, he covers technology for the New York Times. Miguel, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Gene Autry, Katharine Hepburn, and Mother Teresa probably aren't often mentioned in the same breath, but the trio does have at least one thing in common this year. Each is set to be recognized on their own postage stamp. Of course, most people will probably never see those stamps because, well, many of us don't really put stuff in the actual mail anymore. In its last fiscal year, the U.S. Postal Service lost $3.8 billion, which for most companies would be a giant warning to rethink the way it does business. But the post office isn't most companies, as Molly Messick explains from Wyoming Public Radio.
Universal service at a universal rate. It's the key responsibility of the Postal Service, delivering mail to communities large and small. And that's why there are more than 36,000 post offices across the country, even in tiny, far-flung towns.
5250.
Like this one, Rock River, Wyoming, population 235. It's a ranching community on the open plains. Doug Likens is the postmaster here, the only man behind the counter.
Is there anything liquid, perishable, fragile, potentially hazardous?
Or pistachio nuts.
Oh, wow.
But even here, one word is never far from mind, deficit.
The revenue in this office is down a little over 9%.
That's from 2008 to 2009, and that's right on track with the numbers nationally. Now Likens is watching costs closer than ever, even basics like electricity.
The thermostat goes down to about 60 degrees at night. We try to generate as much revenue as we can. When folks come to the counter, I encourage them to use priority mail. I offer delivery confirmation and insurance.
But for the Postal Service, that's nickels and dimes. It needs to do something big. Mail volume has plummeted since 2006, thanks to things like email and paying bills online. Patrick Donahue is the Deputy Postmaster General.
What we're seeing is this. We've lost in the three-year time frame 18% of the volume.
The Postal Service has cut more than 1,400 branches and 180,000 jobs in the last decade. But in rural places, it's a hard sell to close a town post office when there's no other option for 20 miles, and it goes against the mission of the USPS to hike prices in remote towns. But Donahue says those post offices can be expensive.
We've got rural post offices out there that will spend $10 in cost for every $1 we take in revenue.
So what is the Postal Service to do? The biggest change coming could be in Saturday delivery. The agency is planning to ask Congress to let it stop running mail routes 6 days a week. Donahue says that could save $3.5 billion each year. But on a Laramie street, opinions are split.
I'm in favor of it. You know, 5 days a week I think would be sufficient.
If they end Saturday service and, you know, you don't get it till Monday and you needed it on Saturday and...
Oh, gosh, they can end it any time.
A bad idea.
Slightly more official polls, like one from Rasmussen, show that most people would rather see five-day delivery than higher prices or fewer post offices. Donahue says to end Saturday delivery, the agency needs approval from Congress. Once again, rural mail delivery could be a sticking point. Here's Wyoming Senator John Barrasso.
People in Wyoming have for years relied on the Postal Service from the early days of the Pony Express, and I think it's very important to have continued delivery 6 days a week for rural communities in Wyoming.
Barrasso hasn't made a final judgment about Saturday delivery yet, but the Postal Service probably shouldn't count on his vote. Congress could make its decision as early as this spring. In the meantime, the USPS will try to save its bottom line while keeping the mail moving all over the country. In Laramie, Wyoming, I'm Molly Messick for Marketplace.
Coming up, Africans feel the chill in Argentina.
Like, if I went to something like bus or train, when I sit, nobody like to sit behind me. Everybody, they're just like, they're scaring me, you know?
But first, let's do the numbers. It was a mixed market today with an asterisk, though. Most stocks gained, but the Dow Industrial slipped a bit, 11 points down, just a tenth of 1%, finished at 10,572. The NASDAQ picked up just a sliver of a point, closed virtually flat at 2308. The S&P 500 managed to add 3 points, a third of 1%, wrapped up at 1136. That's the S&P's highest close in 15 months, by the way. So if you don't count the Dow, it was a winning day overall. About 8 stocks climbed for every 7 that declined on the New York Stock Exchange. Financial shares rebounded for the 9th straight trading day. Shares of Morgan Stanley, Citigroup, and Bank of America each rallied more than 3%. Yet another day of rising crude, as I mentioned, nudged oil prices higher. Chevron shares gained nearly 0.75%. ExxonMobil stock powered up a 0.33%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done. You can build a team online at elance.com. Give you the business 24 hours a day. Just tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest financial news and reports from around the globe on how the economy is affecting our lives.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The Institute for Supply Management releases its monthly report on how non-manufacturing businesses performed in December. Haven't taken the tree down yet? There's still time. The 12 days of Christmas conclude in some regions with the Christian celebration Epiphany. And it's all about you, people. The red carpet rolls out in Los Angeles for the People's Choice Awards. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
Yes, it's a new year, but we start today's letters back in good old 2009. A couple of weeks ago, we told you about an unexpected decline in new home sales. It was especially baffling because a report just a day earlier about used homes had been pretty good. Analysts and economists alike were left scratching their heads. Not so Christy Johnson, who, she points out, lives in a 1923 Spanish Revival home in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
New versus used is a ploy by the construction industry to denigrate everything that came before this very moment. What would this planet look like if we were all convinced to have brand new construction?
Well, about that brand new construction, in that same show, we reported that some money from the economic stimulus package, specifically the part that is designated for green technology, might eventually go to foreign companies. They've teamed up with American firms to get green projects off the ground. David Kersting from Norwalk, Connecticut, says that's mostly okay with him.
The government should tax U.S. companies the difference in savings that the corporations are receiving when they outsource. That way, the only benefit for a company to outsource would be if they're having trouble finding a particular skill set, not to save a buck by putting another American worker on the unemployment line.
Our New Year's Eve broadcast brought us something new. The big stories of the decade in one rhyming marketplace minute, courtesy of our morning host, Bill Radke. That inspired John Donovan from Alpharetta, Georgia, to respond in kind.
Now that I know what went wrong in the aughts, my folio will reflect I've been well Radke taught. I'm headed for riches, a Beamer, I'm legit. And gee, all it took was a marketplace minute.
Finally this week, a story we did just before Christmas at Union Station, a homeless shelter right outside of Los Angeles, about how families are becoming the new face of homelessness. Better put, that would be families without teenage boys. One of the shelter's clients had explained to us the difficulties she'd had in finding space in a shelter because of her 15-year-old son. That prompted Eric Hurley of Des Moines, Iowa, to write and wonder whether it was gender discrimination or whether all 15-year-olds are excluded. Well, we asked Eric, the perception is, real or not, that boys over the age of 10 can cause some trouble, but there are some family shelters out there that cater to single fathers who have kids. If you have something to say or just something to ask, it's only going to take a minute. Our homepage is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. President Obama convened a high-level meeting with his national security advisors this afternoon to talk about aviation security, after which he stepped up to the microphones.
Immediately after the attack, I ordered concrete steps to protect the American people. New screening and security for all flights, domestic and international. More explosive detection teams at airports. More air marshals on flights. And deepening cooperation with international partners.
And he led on, there will likely be more security to come. Airline executives were watching as closely as any member of the traveling public. They know extra security after the failed Christmas Day bombing in Detroit could conceivably affect their bottom lines. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
So far, airline bookings are steady, and frequent flyers seem resigned to still more time for security. Annette LeBeau, a software developer from Michigan, flies as often as twice a week.
Right now, I know exactly the latest I can leave to get through security in time for my flight. The next time I fly, I'm definitely going to get to the airport earlier.
Right now, there's a tentative recovery in the airline industry, and Julius Maldutis with Aviation Dynamics says some companies have even been able to raise fares.
And the airlines were hoping they would have small earnings for this year. But it really depends on what's going to happen as a result of these security checks.
Airlines know their customers want to feel secure, says industry consultant David Fuskas.
They like to remind people, though, that there is an economic consideration to this. The passenger airline industry is a vital part of the U.S. economy.
Which means, he says, government security measures have to take passenger inconvenience into account. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
If history's any guide, this year more than 1,000 asylum seekers will show up in Argentina. Most of them won't be from South America's traditional sources, places like Peru or Colombia. They will be from Africa. Tougher rules in Europe and the United States have pushed refugees to find new destinations. But what they find in South America is not always what they expect. From Buenos Aires, Ian Mount reports.
Outside one of Buenos Aires' main train stations, commuters squeeze down a sidewalk clogged with vendors hawking toys, food, and underwear. The peddlers shout their prices above the din of city buses. One vendor stands in glum silence next to his costume jewelry, and he stands out. John barely speaks Spanish. He's 23, a recent refugee, and a black African in a country with a population that's almost entirely white. Poverty and political strife made him quit his native Liberia. But he says Argentina is not the promised land either.
There's no work for we refugees. There's nothing for us here.
Well, they do find shelter here, like the dingy boarding houses in the blue-collar San Cristobal neighborhood. A small room here, crammed with four single beds, goes for about $180 a month. Abdulhat Fall, a 25-year-old from Senegal, makes the rent by hawking $3 rings on the street.
Many times you make $15, and once in a while, if you have a big day, you make $30. But there are days you go out to work and you come back with nothing.
For all that, Argentina has its upside. There are liberal policies on immigration. Many remember the 1970s and early 80s when Argentines had to flee overseas to escape the dictatorship at home. The recent refugees from Africa are often helped by the Catholic refugee charity FCCAM. Father Sante Serelin works with the organization. He says Africans first began arriving from Senegal 7 years ago, and their numbers keep growing. Although Argentina is a nation of immigrants, most of those settlers were white. They came from Italy and Spain in the 19th and 20th centuries. The arrival now of thousands of black Africans, just as the economy heads south and crime is rising, is making some white Argentines tense.
I think that there should be more controls on the border, no?
That's Emiliano Mencia, a 28-year-old apprentice bus driver.
There are, for example, a lot of Bolivians, Africans, Brazilians, and Paraguayans, people who cross the border without documents.
Many Africans complain of discrimination. They say Argentines often address them by the names of random famous blacks, such as Pele. It's also common for boarding houses to refuse to rent to them. John, the street vendor from Liberia, says a simple trip across town can be an ordeal.
Like if I went to something like bus or train, when I sit, nobody like to sit behind me. Everybody, they're just like, they're scaring me, you know?
But despite this disillusionment, few Africans will be rushing home.
I'll stay here.
That's Sam, a 28-year-old who stowed away in a boat 18 months ago from his native Ivory Coast. As tough as Buenos Aires might be, he says it's better than back home, where armed police rule the roost and civilian life can be cheap.
If you don't have document, they can shoot you. Right now.
In Buenos Aires, I'm Ian Mount for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
A final note this afternoon to follow on to the story Sam Eaton brought us about commodities up at the top of the broadcast. Gold is one of the more closely watched indicators out there, often taken as a safe haven in times of economic trouble. Based on last year's performance, though, maybe a more broad-based portfolio would be better. Gold prices rose 24% last year, which is nice. Nothing, though, compared to lead, up 145% in 2009. Orange juice from Sam's story, up 107%. I could go on, but I think you get my point. Anyway, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 11 points, a tenth percent. The Nasdaq gained less than a point. That's basically flat. The S&P 500 added 3 points, a third of 1%. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Doug Krisner on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Coming up next time on this broadcast, how companies show off their trash-free factories.
Garbage tours, as I call them. I go through the factory with the customers, and I show them how we manufacture the furniture and how the waste is diverted at each stage of the process.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.